I am interviewing Miss Gina Stanley on Friday, October 29th, around 11:04. And just to kind of begin, would you mind setting like a background, like where you're from, where your family's from, a little bit of background about your family?
Yep. So I'm from a community called Rocky Ford, Oklahoma, which is near a very small town called Oaks, Oklahoma, and that's where I grew up and lived, which is in Cherokee County, and I lived there until I got married. My family, my mother's from Delaware County, which is a little town, which is not far from there, Kansas, Oklahoma, and she was full-blood Cherokee. My grandparents, her parents were both original enrollees when the Dawes Commission came and took the land from the tribes for the last time and then signed them up as registered them as being Indian and gave them their 120-acre allotments of land. That was in 1905. And they were both very small kids, but they got their allotments, and we still own that original land that actually it was left to me. So I still own that original land that's restricted Indian land. My father was from Missouri. Or his family was from Missouri, but he was born and raised in Cherokee County also.
And did you go to school in Cherokee County for your education, like before college?
No, Oaks was about, actually, I lived right on the border of Delaware and Cherokee, so I went to school in Delaware County at that town called Oaks, which is just actually a couple miles from where my home was. And then I went to college in Cherokee County.
What college did you attend?
Northeastern State University in Tahlequah.
Same as me.
Mm-hmm.
What led you to NSU, and what led you to, like, because what was your degree in? Because I know you as an administrator is how I know you through my father. But what led you to that point of becoming an administrator?
I knew I honestly wanted to be a teacher because I had a wonderful teacher in high school that I absolutely adored. And he kind of made me really want to have an impact because he had an impact on my life. And so that's why I wanted to be a teacher, but also went straight into administration I didn't even teach. I went straight through 5 years. I got my master's degree in a year to do administration because I also knew that in education at that point in time, Oklahoma was the lowest paid for teachers in the nation. And I wanted to make sure I could provide for my family if something were ever to happen to my husband at the time. So I decided I wanted to do administration. I'd also spent my first semester in college working for the principal at that school, and it was really disorganized, and I kind of went in and did a lot of work for them after school and on the weekend sometimes and helped out and did a lot of things, and I knew pretty quickly that I had the skills to be an administrator, and he depended on me for a lot of things and kind of told me I should actually think about doing that, and I just decided I was going to get it all done all at once. So when I started having babies, I could take care of them and not be worried about going to school.
Yeah. What was your first administrative job outside of college whenever you graduated with your master's?
I only taught for 2 years, so I was the director of curriculum instruction and counseling for Sequoia High School, which is an off-reservation boarding school. And so I had success with a program the 2 years that I taught and actually coordinated that program, which was for pregnant or parenting teens. And while I was there, there were a lot of issues with their transcripts and things like that. So I worked closely with that administrator, let him know kind of what their issues were too, which is some similar things that I've worked with as I was working through my bachelor's degree. And he pretty quickly saw what I was talking about, and then that program was just a 2-year funding, and I knew that when I took it. And when that program ended, he asked to move me would ask if I would be interested because he had a conversation with Wilma Mankiller, who was the chief at the time. And Wilma asked me to move into administration for a couple reasons. I'd done a great job with that grant program, but I'd also had helped that superintendent a lot getting some things lined up. But one of her big things at that point in time was that she really wanted to see females in administration so that the females there had female role models. And there were females in administration back then, but there were not very many, honestly, and definitely not a superintendent. So I kind of set my sights then to be superintendent, but I kind of bided my time because I wanted to be in all the other areas. So I had really a good grasp of all those positions before I would ever consider applying, because there were a couple, two or three times that the superintendent position came open, but I didn't apply for it because I didn't feel like I was ready myself. I wanted to have a really good grasp of the curriculum side of it, all of those inner workings, so that once I got that level, I felt like I would be able to do a good job managing and directing those separate programs, because we had a lot. I mean, being our off-reservation boarding school, we had a facilities maintenance program. We had residential staff. There were a lot of government regulations called the 25 CFR that we had to meet and maintain for each of those areas. So there was a lot of things that a typical high school superintendent in Oklahoma doesn't really have to abide by. Mm-hmm. We were nationally certified. We were state certified. So we also had to jump through those hoops and make sure that we were meeting all the requirements for the state, the national certification, state certification, BIE regulations, all of those things. So there was a lot more to it than a regular school.
Yeah. Did you see yourself wanting to be in an administrative role at anywhere other than an off-reservation boarding school, or did anything specific other than, like, happenstance, like, make you want to stay at Sequoia and not, like, go to another high school or school where it would have been less regulations? What kept you there wanting to learn all of the issues? Was there anything specific because it served Native peoples, or were you just drawn to the people who were there at the time, so you stayed?
I went through college on a scholarship that was through the Bureau of Indian Education, the BIE at the time. Mm-hmm. BIA actually at that time. I hadn't moved over to the BIE. And I honestly wanted to spend a few years there to kind of give back to the tribe, because it was BIA, but it was filtered through the tribe. The tribe was, Cherokee Nation was the one that dispersed those. So I wanted to give back some time to the tribe, because that's who paid for my education for the most part. I had other grants and things that I took care of myself, loans, whatnot, but the bulk of it came from that. So I wanted to make sure that I kind of gave back to my tribe. And then I got a letter when I graduated from Wilma Mankiller asking me to come and apply for a job there. So I did, and I liked it. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed what I was doing. When I initially went to school, I had no intention of being there, but felt like after the support I got financially, that's why I chose to go there. I was never restricted myself to being in that area. But once I got there, I did enjoy what I was doing, and I did enjoy working for the tribe. And then I actually, the director of the BIE, one of the directors, had saw the success that we had, and really wanted to try to replicate that in some other schools. So he asked me to kind of come on board and kind of help tour some schools and help them set up some things and protocols to try to help those lower performing, because we turned it into a very high performing school in a fairly short period of time, from one of the lower performing. And it was kind of what the chief at the time liked to call a school of last resort. Nobody wanted to go there. And then it quickly became a school of choice because we had a waiting list of students that wanted to get in, and we were held back basically by the number of dorm rooms that we had and the size in terms of our square footage for the capacity of students that we could hold, I guess.
Yeah, and would you mind kind of, do you remember what year you started and what you, because, what year did you start there, and what, do you remember kind of what timeline whenever they were requesting you to tour these schools to help, tour other schools to help with those improvements?
It was after I was in a superintendent position. So it would have been, I think my last 6 years I was superintendent, but I went to work there, I think, in 1987.
And do you remember kind of like, so it was like throughout like the 90s or was it the early 2000s where whenever they were asking you to like go and help with other bureau ran schools or bureau funded schools?
That's probably in the mid 90s.
No, you, cause you were there. That's a lot of shifts in like Native education of like control and shifts. Like, did you see any, what do you remember like any specific shifts you saw at Sequoia? Like, were there like any, more focusing on like native history, because obviously as a native school there's always that presence, but do you remember any shifts where it was more of a focus for the tribes to like, because obviously with like the history of off-reservation boarding schools there's a lot of trying to not teach the native aspect of being, so did you see any shifts, or was it just kind of just seen as just educating students, and they happen to be Native peoples?
No, by the time I got there, so there's two different basically types of schools that the BIE funds. One is a BIE operated, and the other is the grant schools. They operate off of a grant with the tribe, where the tribe has the ability to make decisions. So the BAE is not operating it. It's not following the government procurement system and all of their policies. So that money goes through, I think it's called a 638 contract, where the money goes through the tribe. That way, the other schools, the BAE operated schools, procurement, hiring, all that goes through the government process, which is very lengthy, very cumbersome, very difficult to do anything in it. Timely manner. So then the option of giving it to the tribe and it going through the grant was to allow the grant, one, the tribe to have a little more local control in terms of making sure that language was taught and things like that. So they had the as long as they met the requirements that the 25 CFR laid out, then the tribe had the autonomy to be able to direct things like Indian education programs, language programs, that type of thing. So by the time I got there, it was already a grant program that Cherokee Nation operated. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that was kind of already in place in terms of language, that language was being taught, just kind of making sure that we were respecting and providing cultural opportunities for students, even though being an off-reservation boarding students, not all students were Cherokee. Mm-hmm. But it was still a place where students had a lot of, they felt very, I don't know, I felt it's a place where there was a lot of where they felt like they fit in because there were other Native students, especially those that were coming off of reservations where that was their primary, who they primarily, you know, engaged with were other Native people.
Mm-hmm. Did the school offer more languages than Cherokee?
No.
How do you, this might be kind of outside of like the premise of this, but do you remember how hard, was it difficult getting a language speakers like to like teach a student? Or was it just people who were already formally trained?
Let me take a step back to, we did teach Spanish for a college curriculum for those that were college bound. As far as another native language, no, we did not. And no, we never had trouble finding language speakers. We were really blessed with that regard. And one of the reasons being that we entered into an agreement with the Oklahoma State Department of Education, mm-hmm. that they did not, they could be teachers and certified teachers where the students got actually basically a foreign language credit from the state, which is a requirement for graduation and for college entrance, but they were that we, as long as the tribe certified those teachers, they didn't have to have a state certification as a teacher. So those, we still met the requirements of having an accredited person, but it was based on accreditation, and the tribe set up an accreditation process. So those speakers had to be credited through the tribe, then the state recognized that that credit or that certification for state requirements. So You might have had another question in there that I might have
No, that's perfect. There's just, like, from what you're saying, there's just so many moving pieces that, like, that Sequoia had to and still probably has to go through to serve Native students like it does, at the level that it does.
Yes. Absolutely.
Which, it's just something I don't really think about because I, like, of course my father taught at Sequoia and was there when you were there. But it's just, I'm so used to the public school aspect, so I don't have to think about those complicated factors.
Right.
On that.
Right.
Did you, did anybody try to get you to go to another school that wasn't Sequoia? Did any other, tribal schools try to kind of poach you?
Oh, yeah. The Cherokee actually was, at the time, my father got sick and where we found out his cancer was back and that there was no treatment for it. So I decided to stay at Sequoia, but I was offered a job at with the Cherokee tribe in North Carolina, the Eastern Band. Mm-hmm. And it was a very, very, very good offer. Actually, I had several along the way that had tried to get me to come to work for them. And the director of the BAE tried to get me to come to work for them in DC as well. But my kids were small and the money would have been nice, but my being there and being present for my kids was more important than anything.
Yeah. No, I mean, yeah, it seems like that's what kept you in Oklahoma, like family and just being able to be present.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because you told me a lot about, like, your time. Did you have, like, I think in our pre-interview and before that, you told me and my parents, like, your mom, through your mom and other family, you kind of have other connections to Sequoia. Would you be comfortable talking about those connections?
Sure. I joked with my mom about it over the years, about how if she'd been there when I was there, I'd have probably had to kick her out because she was kind of a rowdy little thing. But, you know, she had to be back then to survive. When she was 4 years old, her mother died of tuberculosis. And so that was just post-depression, and the economy was still in really bad shape. And so my grandpa was a fairly young man who had 4 kids that he was caring for, and so he didn't even tell him, honestly. She said she later found out he wrote a letter to Jack Brown, who there's a treatment center. He's a former superintendent at Sequoia, and there's a treatment center that's named after him. He had wrote a letter to them letting them know that he was concerned about caring for the kids. And at that time, it was an orphanage that was for students or children that had been orphaned by one or both of their parents.
I think I kind of lost the connection with you, Miss Stanley. Hello, can you hear me? I can hear you. There we go. I think it reconnected. Can you hear? There we go. It reconnected. Can you hear me?
Are you there?
Yes, there we go.
Okay, mine look good. My connection's not sure what's going on.
I don't know. I think it reset. It might be my side. I'm sorry about that.
No worries. Where did I lose you?
You're telling me your grandfather was making, like, didn't really tell them what was going on after your mother's mother passed away.
Yeah, so, I mean, he just showed up on a Saturday morning, Jack Brown, and picked up the 4 children and took them and put them in Sequoia, and they were there. And she stayed there until I think she was in the 9th grade, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
But she did run away a couple of times just because she missed her dad and wanted to see her dad. And she said she can remember when he would pull up or when he would be coming in the building, they'd bring him up, letting them know he was there. And she said she could remember just watching him and thinking what a handsome man he was coming through there, and so excited she got to see her daddy again. And then she ran away a few times, and he told her, he said, all right, you're old enough, you can come back. I mean, so he put her in Kansas high school there in Kansas, Oklahoma, and she graduated from there and then went on to be a nurse. But she talked about her time at the boarding school and how difficult it was. I mean, they weren't allowed to speak their language. They were punished for speaking the language, and none of the children now speak it, because by the time she left there, she had lost basically all of it. her and her sister would kind of hide under the bed and talk because they didn't want to get in trouble. Mm-hmm. But she said it was very intimidating. They were very institutional and not caring, not loving the people that cared for them. And it was just, it was a tough time for a little girl to have to endure. She talked about like starting her period, not knowing, nobody had prepared her or told her what was going on. She didn't know what was going on and she was scared to death. And just, I think about the heart, how hard all that had to be for her. And she was such a good mama to have endured all that.
But you said like their dad was able to visit them. Like, did she ever talk about being able to go home, or they kind of just stayed there most of the year?
Pretty much stayed there most of the year. He would come a couple times a year, she said, to see him. But not having had a mom to model how to love and be sweet and kind and do, she was a very, very good mom, considering she didn't have that role model.
Mm-hmm. And that was when, like, that was before Sequoia was still the orphan. Was that still when it was kind of, like, functioning as an orphanage, or were kids, like, of any age put in there?
They were all ages, but there were lots of kids that went to school there, and they had to farm. They had to grow their own vegetables, and they all had to work out in the farms. They had a dairy. They had hog pens, and they took care of all that. And they basically grew their own food and vegetables and all of that. So they had lots of pretty tough chores that they had to do. Mm-hmm. And people were mean to them. And I mean, they were just, like she said, I definitely learned how to fight while I was there. She had to fight for herself and her little sister, because she said my little sister was, who grew up, she said, to be kind of on. Yeah. I had to pay for it, I guess.
Yeah. Thinking on, like, because, like, you, did you grow up hearing stories that she would tell you, or she didn't tell you these until you guys were older?
Not until we were older. Actually, probably more so once I started working there. Mm-hmm. I mean, but you know, having worked there too and worked with a lot of people that were alumni, and we had an alumni banquet every year. There were a lot of people that were so very close because they grew up there and grew together. But that was something that, you know, I noticed, like, I had a board member there. His name was Foreman Ross. He's a wonderful man and a very good board member. And he was very, you know, just very engaged with the school and attended all the things, and just the state championships when our kids went to play state, was very involved, and it brought a lot of people back. The success we had academically and athletically when we were there, and got people a lot more engaged. And I would see people who were very close friends and said remain close friends throughout their lives. But that's something that my mom never had, and I don't know if it's because she stayed closer to her siblings or what, but I mean, remember, I can honestly say I don't remember one person that she said, oh, we were classmates at Sequoia, and you know, that she stayed in contact with. And I always wondered why that was, but I never asked her.
Yeah. Did, like, knowing these, like, this history of the school that you were at, did it make you feel that you had to do anything extra because of what the history of it? Or was it just something that you just got, just because you were because of how you were serving Native students then, it was just something that wasn't really a prevalent factor?
I think coming into it, knowing that it had such a negative connotation, and that being where I wound up, you know, I was very admired Wilma Mankiller very much, and when she said she wanted me to be in that role, I was hesitant at first because I had my summers off. I was teaching. I was off during the summer. I had 3 months with my boys, and we'd play and do the things we want to do in the summer. And I knew when she moved me into administration that I would be more of a year-round employee. And I wasn't ready to do that because my boys were so small. And so I actually only had one at that time. I had the other one while I was there, but I felt like I was a really good teacher too, and that I was just not wanting to move from being in direct contact with students to being more in an administrative role. But I quickly learned that I could do a lot more for those students in an administrative role than I could in a classroom because I had an impact on all of them and not just a few. Mm-hmm. And so I think that...
I'm so sorry. I think I lost you on audio. Hello, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I think I lost you on audio for some reason. Like, I can... Like, everything's fine on that, but not on audio. But I can't believe I haven't asked you this because you mentioned it. What subject did you teach?
I had a business certification. So business education.
Business education.
Mm-hmm. But when they put me in as a teacher, I was in an alternative role. So I worked with the teachers that were over at Sequoia. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably what made me realize there was no solid curriculum. No, it was not a good situation, just to be quite honest with you. There were a lot of teachers that loved the kids, that were there for the kids, and there were a lot of teachers that were there for a paycheck, and then there were just, it was just a difficult situation because I knew how, I mean, I could tell by what work I was given, because I was supposed to be given the same work that was there, that the quality of the curriculum that was being taught was not good, and that was one of the things that had to change. I mean, that's why I embraced that administrator role. Was happy to kind of, after I got started in it, I really enjoyed what I was doing because I had the autonomy to take it and make it a better situation for students.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like it, if there wasn't a chief, like, Wilma Mankiller at the time, do you feel like it would have been as good as a process for it to happen, or do you think someone like Curtis made it just easier to happen because of what direction she wanted to take it?
I think that was it, and then it followed up. I mean, the chief following that was Chad Smith, and he kind of picked up. Well, there was Joe Bird and then Chad Smith, but they were both very supportive of, you know, what we were doing and trying to make those changes. And it took a while to get it to come about, but it was so very worth it. It was a lot of hard work. A lot of people that, you know, they'd been able to do what they wanted to do for so long, and they were very, very hesitant to change, but they all moved in the right direction and came on board. And we really had a solid team, and everybody was directing and going in the right direction, the same direction, and pulling together to make it a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in all areas, residential facilities. We had a wonderful facility management group that just, whether it was getting a football field ready or, you know, we're growing and we need some more space, can you turn this closet into an office area? I mean, whatever we needed, they were always there for it. And they, you know, that's, we were going back and forth trying to get funding for a new gym and things like that. So there were a lot of support from the tribe and a lot of support from the community, and it became an amazing place. And I left, it's been about a little over 11 years ago, almost 12 years ago. And you know, when I left, it was one of the top performing BIE schools in the nation. We had tremendous number of Gates Millennium Scholars and Division I athletes and just lots of things that we were extremely proud of, because those were things that didn't happen for our Native kids back in the day. So,
yeah, I remember being in that tiny gym.
Oh my gosh, that was awful.
It was always so crowded, because I mean, thinking back on that and thinking on, like, when you say, like, the community, like, alumni, and everyone was starting feeling, like, whenever success in sports and academia was happening, I think of that community, like, because that's something that is very hard to replicate. Do you think, like, community came because of that Native base, even if it was intertribal?
Yeah, I do. I mean, because I do, 100%. Cherokee Nation has a big presence in the town of Tahlequah. There were a lot of people that were supportive, and they were all alumni. So it was the community as a whole that came around and supported what we were doing.
Did you, being like in, obviously, like you, as administrator, you think like not only like in the state, but national level, because of all the standards that you had to meet But did you ever face, did you ever feel any like pushback from like Oklahoma or other Oklahoma schools because of Sequoia, or was there always?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, big time. I mean, especially as our teams grew and strengthened and grew, and then we became state contenders each year in sports, athletic programs, every program grew and excelled. And it was a good, I mean, we fed off the success in our athletics spilled over into the academic part, and it just kind of supported each other. But, yeah, as we grew, there were a lot of schools that were very, very – I sit on a committee with the state Oklahoma OSSAA, and it was a legislative committee that they would put together. And I mean, there was a lot of very negative feelings about Sequoia, and they said that we recruited and all this because we got kids from other states. We always got kids from other states, but we didn't check their athletic abilities when we got applications. We based those on who. It came to a point, it was first come, first served. Nobody was given extra merit because they were an athlete. It was just the same process that every student had. And when you look at it, like, we didn't have a district that we had to follow or that we could follow. So even if a student was across the street from Sequoia, they were not automatically eligible. We basically had to fill eligibility out on every student that came along. And to say that we recruited was difficult because Native people make up a very small percentage of the people in the state of Oklahoma, and they had to be Native to go there. So that was kind of, we were very limited in a lot of ways that people didn't want to look at. They just saw that we were state champions in softball or basketball, girls basketball, boys basketball for so many years. They had a lot of negative feelings toward us because that was the only thing they could really throw out there at us, I guess.
Yeah. No, having talked to my mom and stuff in the past, like, just like while we were there, because I was young, like, I remember the feeling of things, but I don't remember the actual events. So my mom kind of has that more perspective of like how other people like saw us coming in the gym as like the Native school. Did you have to combat like any, because you were there through like late 80s, early 90s to 2000s, did you have to like deal with any like buddy treating Sequoia differently because it was all Native, like because of the Native aspect, regardless of like the federal or partisanship, like the racism or anything? Did you have to face any of that?
Yeah, there was a lot of negative comments, a lot of negative, especially when you got to the state tournament, it got to be very, very competitive for highly touted award as a state championship of any kind. And it was lots of negativities we had to deal with. Lots of racial slurs and comments. And I mean, I'm sure those are still happening today, to be honest with you.
Yeah. I mean, is there any specific event you can remember or that you had to, because I feel like an administrative role, there's a lot more weight of on your reaction versus just a fan supporting like kids that you care about because they're at that event.
No, I mean, nothing that really stands out. There were numerous times that things like that were happening, and it was always, I mean, we always had our staff meetings with our coaches and our, whether it was our coaches or our academic teams, you know, whatever, our staff, is when situations like that happen, you know, we were probably one of the first ones to really come on board and do a good safety protocol where we brought FBI people in to kind of help us evaluate the safety of our campus because of school shootings and things like that happen, and develop a good plan of if something happened, what teachers were to do and how to react and to protect students. And we were, I think one of the things that when I first came on board is I said, you know, I spent my first, as principal, my first probably 6 months being reactive to everything. And I over that summer, we put a lot of things in place. I said, I don't want to be reactive anymore. I want to be proactive and make sure that we're doing things that are always have our students' safety in the best position that they can be. So we basically, discuss all those types of situations, and they'd happened before, and it was just like, you know, we're going to make sure our kids hold their heads high and that we as teachers or bus drivers or whoever it is, that we're getting kids back to a bus or back on a bus and getting them out of there and getting them out of that situation, because for one, we don't want them exposed to the negative comments, but two, we don't want a fight to break out or something like that to happen. So we were proactive on a lot of those parts. So there were, we didn't put our kids in terrible situations like that.
How long were you a principal before you before you took that superintendent role on?
I was probably principal for maybe 5 or 6 years. I'm not even really sure. I haven't thought Sequoia in so many years because I've just been doing other things. You're catching me off guard on some of them.
No.
I should have got my face down.
No, I mean, like, exact years aren't, it's just like how, like, your feelings and experience while you're there are more important than, oh, this July 4th, 2006. That's way more important than the specific dates. I also have another question of, like, because obviously, like, tribal demographics are so hard to, like, lay down, so I'm not going to try to put you on the spot for that. But did all the students live on campus, or were there some students who lived close enough nearby? Like, how hard was that to tackle? Like, did majority of students live on campus at the time when you were there?
No, the majority actually were. We ran a bus route, and we had students that drove in, being high school students. We had students whose parents worked at the tribe and would drop them off because it was in such close proximity. And then we had students whose parents worked there that came in with their parents. And actually the numbers that were in the residential program began to diminish after a while, and they were getting lower and lower. It was a combination.
Okay. Looking at, like, whenever, as obviously as principal and superintendent, you have the role of, like, hiring people on. Do you kind of remember the demographics of, like, the teachers that you guys would hire? Like, were they more Native or white, Black, or were they just kind of, obviously, whoever's better for the job? But I don't know if you noticed, kind of, because it was a Native school, if it just drew more Native applicants.
Initially, it did when I first got there, but that started to change. And I think, whether people agree with it or not, and I'll take a step back. I said we were status certified. We had to meet their requirements, the national certification, all of this and that. And we also had to meet the requirements of Cherokee Nation because they operate us. So part of the hiring policies for Cherokee Nation were that Native applicants got preference over a non-Native. And then that was something that as the years went by, we had to do a lot of documentation and justification, but, you know, in all aspects, we kind of moved to we want the best teacher in the classroom, regardless. And so there were times that we really, and I would get called, this person was Native and this wasn't, but then you also look at the record and the quality, and it was a matter of, we want the best teacher in the classroom facing our students. Okay. So they kind of worked with us on that and allowed us to be more picky and do a better job of putting the best quality educator or coach or whatever in those positions.
Do you, as, like, not only, like, having taught at Sequoia, but just being an educator and administrator in Oklahoma, is there anything that, like, you see now that that educators continue to have to react to, that you feel is similar, that you had to react to when you were in those roles? Or is it just,
wait, like, say that again?
Because obviously, having been an educator, you still see, like, things in the news that are happening, like with the Oklahoma teacher walkout a few years ago. Like, are these issues that you think are new, or were you dealing with them then when you were still in those roles?
I see a lot of similarities in the things that happen. I see that we've also come a long way and gotten past a lot of those that But we, as a part of, for example, the teacher walkout, one of the first things that I changed as a superintendent was because I wanted to attract better quality teachers. I wanted to attract better quality folks was that we did take the state scale and we had a 5% increase. So teachers that we wanted it to take place that we attracted the quality teachers, coaches, mm-hmm. whatever, for our students. So we actually paid above what the state scale was then. And the other part was just knowing that our teachers are worth more than what they're being paid. So mm-hmm. we increased that. We increased stipends so that we could attract better quality. But, I mean, those are all things that, I mean, there's some things like that that are going to continuously. Teachers aren't paid enough. Teachers aren't, I mean, for what they do. They're one of the most important people that influence children in society. So, you know, just I see a lot of things that, like with the pandemic, I did not have to go through anything like that. But I still work with and consult in school districts. So I see what a difficulty that is placed on educators. So I have the utmost respect for teachers and administrators and miss it from time to time. I've actually had a couple of times in the last 12 years that I've been out of education where I've had districts reach out to me and ask me to apply because they had a superintendent position open. And I just, as much as I wanted to at those times, my son was still playing college football and I still wanted to be accessible to him. Or I've, you know, had situations within my family where I wanted to have a little more flexibility, so I didn't take them. But it did take a long time some solid consideration because I do miss being in education.
Mm-hmm. One last, like, bigger question about Sequoia, and then I do want to, like, look at, like, where you're at now in your life and, like, what you did after Sequoia. Do you think that Sequoia will always be needed in the essence of, like, a Native school serving Native children and Native students?
I do. I think that I saw too many students that had come from public schools that had not had success, mm-hmm. that once they were around other Native students where they felt like they fit in or felt like they had some common ground or some an ability to relate to them, I saw them flourish and do extremely well. Not being close to Sequoia and not having, not knowing, you know, all the ins and outs of what's going on now. I don't know what changes have been made, but I do know that it was no matter what, there were some students that it was their last resort.
Yeah.
I mean, and they were able to graduate and do well and excel. I can remember students who came in from school districts that were on IEPs who, when we tested off the charts, but they're because of cultural reasons, they didn't speak out or they didn't react the way a teacher wanted them to react, and that, you know, they were not special ed students and excelled once they got there. So I think there's so much of the tribal or the cultural component of Sequoia that allows students to be successful or feel like they're a part of a community where they are safe or can speak out or fit in, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. No, the more and more I get into, like, looking at different aspects of Native education, especially, like, from, like, the 70s to now, it's so complicated. So I really do think insights like yours really do offer a really good lens into not just numbers, but feeling and seeing these students.
It is. It's kind of interesting. I mean, it's very, very interesting. But I mean, I just having been able to witness some of those kids who never flourished and become very outspoken and, you know, excited about going to college when they'd never thought about going to college or not had success, but had, even if they just bonded with a teacher or somebody there, a residential person, somebody that made them feel wanted, maybe they'd never experienced even that in their lives growing up. It was a life changer for so many students. And I was super proud to be a part of of that. And I mean, even as a teacher, I had my own situation where there were students who had never witnessed or experienced success in education in any way, but taking time and spending it with them and just giving them the confidence that they needed and making them believe in themselves and seeing what a difference it made in their lives was just absolutely one of the most rewarding things I've ever experienced.
Yeah, that just shows to me, just being the daughter of two educators, how good at your job just those feel like, of course, with your experience, but your just passion for that just shows how good you were there and just at caring about students.
Well, thank you. I think part of it too is just like I was an athlete in school and I'm very competitive in a lot of areas and I didn't like the negative connotation that people had about Sequoia at that time. And I knew that it had the potential to be better and to be a place where students would want to come. And it was just, and it, you know, having got to be a part of seeing that change and come about was very beneficial, and always having the support of the administration, the tribe, the community, you know, after a while, once we turned that negativity around, was just super rewarding.
Yeah, no, and I mean, Sequoia is still a name, like sports-wise or academics-wise, that carries some weight. So it's really interesting, like you were a part of that shift to where it is now.
I'm happy that I got to be a part of that. Like, I think as much as I loved going to the state championship every year too, just, you know, there was a year that we had the highest number of Gates Millennium Scholars in the country was just a huge feather in our cap too, because it was like, you know, we're as important as athletics are to us, so is academics. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, making sure that our athletes were, you know, met the academic requirements and not fudging on any of those, and making sure that they knew that, you know, if you're going to play, you're going to compete in the classroom too, and you're going to work and you're going to earn the grades so that you can represent us on the court. And it becomes such a sense of pride for them too, to be able to put on the uniforms. And that was something else. I mean, we started, you know, funneling our resources into giving. I think that was kind of exciting for me too, because I mean, there was a lot of graffiti. I mean, I remember the first time I walked on the campus, I walked past students that were smoking as you entered the building, and there was a teacher that just walked past them and didn't even say anything. And I mean, that was one of the first things that I was going to fix. And I literally, you know, just pulled them in a meeting, you know, once we got started. And I said, I never want to see a teacher walk past a student if they're not following rules that we have. If we're not going to make them follow the rules, there's no point in having rules. So it was a really tough shift in making those kinds of changes. And a lot of it was, you know, getting those teachers out that didn't want to be there, that didn't care, that didn't have high expectations for our students too, because it was really sad. I can honestly tell you there were a handful of teachers that didn't believe that our kids were as smart as other kids in public schools. It didn't mean, I mean, it was just like, it was sad to me to see that that's how they felt. And they weren't there very long. I mean, they were gone. They moved. I got them out. We weren't going to have that. We were going to have teachers. And then my biggest thing to them is, if it's not good enough for your student, your child, it's not good enough for these students. So that's the bottom line. Mm-hmm. And just having them, teaching them, you know, changing the whole culture, changing the whole perception. And one of it was like facilities. I met with facilities and I took a hard line on, you know, if you see graffiti go up on a wall, we're not worried about who did it or what happened. We're painting over it immediately. They'll eventually quit if they see that it's not getting them anywhere. And one day, I walked by down the hall and I saw my niece was actually going to school there at the time, and I saw her initials and I recognized her handwriting, and it was between the bells, and I was so mad. But I waited till the bell rang, and then I went, I've got a hold of facilities. I said, I need you to bring me a paintbrush and some paint. And I walk into her classroom and I said, your initials are on the wall outside. Here's a bucket of paint, a paintbrush, I need you to go paint over that. That's not how we're going to represent our school. That's not, we're not going to defile our school or, you know, this, that's just, it's not acceptable. We're not having it. So I need you to go fix that. And as I saw people's names that I recognized or whatever, I made them do it. I said, the facilities didn't do this. It's not their job to fix what you've messed up. So you go fix it yourself. I embarrassed her so bad. She just couldn't believe it. But I mean, and it stopped. It didn't take long. It stopped. We didn't have people disrespecting the school or the walls or the facilities or the building. And if we knew who did it, they fixed it.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like it's taking, like, showing that your own family. It's like, no, no, nobody's going to get away with doing this. It's the pride thing. No, that's, you're absolutely right. That is funny.
She wasn't funny, but she laughs about it now.
Yeah, years after the fact, I bet. after like, helping change so much at Sequoia, how long were you superintendent before you left?
I think it was 6 years.
6 years?
I think so.
Okay. Do you mind talking about, like, what led you to leave?
Yes. So my son signed to play football, and about a year before I left, I had a person from a company that was recruiting me to come to work for him, and I kind of put him off for a while. And it might not have been even quite a year, but once my son signed to play football at the University of Mississippi, and I was adamant about, to tell him, I would talk to teachers and anybody. It was like, you know, a lot of these students don't have parents, especially those that are from other states, to come watch them play. They know who's in the stands. They know who's sitting there watching them and who cares about them. So any time that you can take time away from your family to be there, I'd like for you to be there. So I was not going to not be that same person and expect other people to be there when I couldn't. So when our games, you know, were over on Friday night, then I would leave for my son's game in Mississippi. So, or wherever he played in the SEC. So it could have been anywhere, but his home games were in Mississippi. So I would wait till our games were over on Friday night and I would leave. So they played televised games at 11:30, 2:30, or 6:30. If they had an 11:30 game on Saturday, I basically drove all night and maybe slept a couple of hours and went to his game. Well, it was my baby, and I wanted to spend time with him. So as soon as the game was over, I would, you know, would want to hang out with him and help him either cook things for him to eat during the week, you know, and put in his fridge and or whatever, just kind of and just be there with him, go eat with him, do things with him. Because I wanted him to stay and be success. There was a lot of not providing, a lot of schools didn't offer native students Division I contracts because so many of them in the past, they'd offer them a Division I scholarship and they would go back because they would be homesick or whatever. So after killing myself the first year and trying to be there, I mean, on those 11:30 games, I would come back a zombie on Monday morning, but I was there on time and I did my job. So it got to be pretty hard and I decided I could go back to education at some point, but that company had offered me that job and I decided to go ahead and take it so that I could be accessible to him. And they were making it pretty sweet. They said they'd fly me in and out of all of his games. And, so I went to work for, at that time it was Plato Learning.
I mean, you really can't argue with, especially the flying you to your children's games. Cause that's how
I wound up not doing it anyway because my mom was all like, I sure would like to go to his games. I wound up driving her to most of them anyway, but at least it was easy for me to be there. And they offered me the territory of working in Mississippi so that I could be there as often and as much as I wanted to be.
And you said it was Plato Learning?
Mm-hmm.
Was that more like an administrative role or was that kind of like, would you mind saying like, what is Plato Learning? Cause you're not still with that company, are you?
No, it's an ed tech company.
Tech.
Education technology, yeah.
And how different was that role from you being an administrator and an educator?
It was different in a sense, but I was able to, I requested them. I said, you know, I would like to work Mississippi so I can be there for my son. But I said, I would also like to work with the Bureau of Indian Education Schools if I could, because I want to stay connected to Indian education. So I was, they were good enough to give that to me. So I worked with them, and then I worked from there. I went to a company. I wasn't even there quite a year, and a company called me and asked me to come apply for a job, and they flew me into Minneapolis, and I really liked what they were doing because literacy was such a big need in our native communities. Because mm-hmm. I, you know, we did our research at Sequoia at the time I was there. The majority of our students were entering as a freshman, but functioning on average at seventh grade level. So that meant those students were, some of them were well below, because you also had some that were exceeded with their level, high school, college level was. So, I wanted to go to work with them. So that company was Coughlin Companies, and I worked with them for about 8 years, 7 or 8 years before they were acquired by Renaissance. And so I'm still with Renaissance, who acquired. Actually, it was Francisco Partners, and then Francisco Partners sold to Renaissance, and then Renaissance, or then Francisco Partners bought Renaissance. So it's been kind of a little bitty interesting roller coaster over the few years. But basically, I've been with those three companies. I actually never left Mion once I started that company.
You it can't stay away from education, can you?
Can't. Cannot.
Has like, in what do you mind describing, like, kind of what you currently do for the company you're at now?
Yeah, so I'm actually an account executive, and so I inherited accounts, all the BIE accounts that use the assessment or practice products that Renaissance Learning uses. So I work in North Texas and the BIE. Mm-hmm. So I get to work with those districts, but with the BIE, I kind of still get to share and consult with them on some things that we did and some ideas that they can kind of work to kind of solve some issues that they have within their schools. And I've enjoyed immensely keeping and maintaining those relationships with those educators. And some of them are educators that I worked with when I was superintendent, and, you know, we would be at conferences together, just kind of got to know people through that. So mm-hmm. I maintain a lot of those relationships, and I appreciate that. There's some good people who dearly care about Native students and their well-being and their growth. And, you know, our Native students are still the only minority that hasn't grown. And this is pre-COVID, but had not grown. They've flatlined with regard to literacy rates. And I always took offense to that because I knew how intelligent our kids were. But so much of those numbers are based on the fact that, you know, access to reading materials in the home, lack of access to those, lack of access to technology, those types of things that hopefully with all the funding that came about with the CARES Act and mm-hmm. all of that, that hopefully some of those have resolved and that won't be the case in the future. But I know education is facing a very difficult time right now with the learning loss that COVID has brought about. So part of what I get to do now is kind of help provide resources to schools that are interested in it, ways to accelerate that learning and get to where they need to be, because remediation is not the answer to where we're at with the COVID loss. Acceleration is. So it's about accelerating learning now and getting them where they need to be.
And so you're in working in tangent with like all the BIE schools or only like a certain like?
No, it's just certain ones. So to be honest with you, the BIE at one point used an assessment with a company that is actually a competitor to our company. Mm-hmm. And they had the entire BIE purchased it for the schools and they used that. So they just took that out now, so there's a lot more schools that are coming on board, but I only work with the handful that either I've worked with and they're coming on board now, or have used STAR assessments or Accelerated Reader or some of the practice programs that we have.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like you just keep going like higher and higher and more complex systems. Like within that, because like that's a lot of AR. So what system did you say like your company uses? AR and what? STAR?
STAR assessments. So there's a suite of assessments from early literacy where you can assess. Mm-hmm. It's a universal screener, and then it's interim assessments where you can do progress monitoring to see where your students are, and it builds into focus skills so you know specifically the skills that they're lacking and where they need to go from there and what they need to focus on. And then we tie to all of the state assessments, and so we can actually predict how they're going to do in the state assessments. Accelerated Reader is the product that started the company, so Accelerated Reader, a lot of people know what that is because it's been so widely used in school districts for a lot of years. I don't know the exact year, but they just had an anniversary recently. They are. But we also have practice programs called Freckle that are math, ELA, science, social studies. And we have a Lalilo product where it focuses on foundational literacy, which is a phenomenal program. My Own Reader, which is an enhanced digital library that grows reading and is phenomenal because it puts access to thousands of books in students' hands, no matter where they are, as long as they have access to an internet or with a device where they can download those books. Mm-hmm. And then we have Nearpod, which is another program that's acquisition by our company, where they are, it's a platform for similar to PowerPoint, but it's more interactive and a lot more sophisticated and user-friendly for districts. So a lot of different programs that are products that our company offers.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just so funny because I can't tell a tangent between my parents because my parents just can't stay away from education or like trying to help students grow. And it really sounds like that's like your whole trajectory is like you're still like in systems of like trying to help students succeed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And your dad was a phenomenal coach and a great teacher. I think it was his first teaching job ever was there, but he really cared about kids and he learned quickly and from a good mentor that, you know, these students today that he worked with are lucky to have him.
Oh, yeah. Well, because I was young and obviously we were there when my little brother was born. So we definitely view Sequoia. And that's the reason why, I do, tie Sequoia in with, what I, like to look into with education. Just because it's not only impeccable people like yourself who were drawn to and stayed there for reasons. But it's such a personal thing because I did really feel a sense of community. While my dad was coaching there, and I mean, I'm Native, my dad's white, but he was very within that community. So it's just it's so personal on that aspect, and I just do think that work of administrators like you should be acknowledged of bringing schools like that, schools to that level, that when people didn't see that it would ever get to that level.
And there was a lot of people pulling together and pulling in the same direction. And I'm blessed to have that as part of my resume. And I
don't know why my Wi-Fi is being weird today. I'm sorry. But can you still hear me?
I can hear you now.
Perfect. No, I don't know why today my Wi-Fi is deciding to hate me. Of all days. But no, is there anything about your experience at Sequoia or just as an educator administrator that you just really want recorded, of your experience or what you think that your experience meant to you or just any thoughts on it?
I think going back to my mom and the boarding school negative connotations of everything that happened, there was a lot of negative, and it was someplace that my mother wasn't happy to be. And I think that part of that and knowing what she went through was kind of another driving force with me to want to make that a place where students were never, ever treated like that again or belittled or made to feel less of. And And I feel like we accomplished that. So I think a lot of what I did and brought to be about there was basically focused on my mom and, you know, what she had experienced and wanting to make it better so that kids didn't feel that way again. And then when I worked, when I interviewed that second job, I told you I went to work for Play Learning. When I interviewed for that second job, and I was sitting in the interview in Minneapolis, I listened to what they were presenting, and it was a literacy program called My Own Reader, and listened to the, you know, president, the guy that had actually developed My Own, talk about it, and he was trying to develop, you know, a sales force for the program or for the product, and he, you know, I was going to be the first outside salesperson basically for that product. And as he was telling me what the product did, I knew without a doubt that was going to have an impact on helping kids grow reading, because it was meeting them where they were. It was allowing them to hear through audio recordings fluent readings, and it would help build the fluency piece of it. It would also help pronunciation, vocabulary, all those things, because there were a lot of tools that were embedded to scaffolds that were embedded to help students. And the first thing I thought of were all the BI schools that had lower level schools or lower level reading, because a lot of them had come from language homes where they only spoke their native language. And so there was that disparity for those students. So as I listened to him, I asked him, I said, can I ask you some questions about it now? And he said, yes. And I said, if I were to come to work for you, one, would you let me work with the BIE schools? Because I see a serious need for this in names. And my granddaughter was 3 at the time, and I put her on it, and she just took it and ran with it. And I mean, she was reading. It was funny because my daughter-in-law came home after her first day or two of school and said, they want to know what we've done with Lainey. And it was this program. She'd see my computer and she'd want to read books. And so anyway, as I was in that interview, I said, if it would work out and we could get folks to come on board, is this something that you would allow us to read books, let us translate books into the native languages for tribes that were interested in doing that? And I told him about my mother's situation at a boarding school and the reason that I didn't speak my language, the reason she had lost her language. And I said, and I also, you know, we started an immersion program while I was superintendent at Sequoia. And part of that was we learned real fast that the students learned so quickly that we were behind in materials for them to read. And I said, this would be something that they could use, you know, because we had books in math and English and social studies and science. And I said, this could really benefit immersion programs, but for, you know, it'd support language programs within the communities. Is it something that we would consider? And he said, and they offered me the job on the spot. And I said, if I were to take the position, I said, I want to think about it. I want to go home and see how, you know, my granddaughter responds and just kind of think about it. But is it something that you'd consider doing? And I made him promise me that we would before I left. And it was funny because he told my son years later, he met my son, he goes, at your mom's interview, he said, the CEO of that, because I interviewed with both of them, the CEO said, you know, at the end of the interview, I was hoping I got the job. He said, she turned the tables on. That's so fast. And we have done that. We have translated books into other tribal languages for tribes. And it's pretty, every time one comes out, it just makes me so excited and so proud, because I'm part of that too. Was just kind of a legacy of my mom's and what she went through and endured as a child in a boarding school.
No, that's a great legacy for both of you, for that impact and that continuing relationship that you created with that.
No. It's pretty neat.
No, that's amazing. And I just want to thank you again for your time and sharing these stories and your experience with me.
I'm happy to. So if you need anything else, you know how to reach me.
Oh, yeah, of course.